Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Warning. This episode contains details that some listeners may find disturbing. I'm comfortable in assuming that we all share a particular image of pirates that comes from popular literature and movies, similar to knights in shining armor or tough cowboys fighting bandits. We have an adventurous and romantic notion about buccaneers sailing the seven seas, searching for buried treasure and scurvy men growling, "Yarr!" But the true history of piracy is much more complex, and its mysteries are just as amazing as Treasure Island or Captain Jack Sparrow. Today we look at some of the most mysterious stories of the Golden Age of piracy. This is a study of strange. Historians mark the Golden Age of piracy from roughly 1650 to 1730, a period when Anglo-French privateers, basically for-hire soldiers, were laid off after the War of Spanish Succession. But these sailors continued their fighting ways because lucrative cargoes and weak colonial governments allowed thousands of sailors to reinvent themselves as pirates. Yet before we dive into the bigger pirate mysteries, it's worth dispelling some of the small, common myths. Like, did pirates fly the Jolly Roger, the infamous skull and crossbones flag? It turns out, they did run black flags to intimidate targets, but there was no single Jolly Roger style or design. The skull and crossbones appears in a French description of Captain Emmanuel Wynne's flag in 1700, while other pirates added their own little personal flavor to designs like hourglasses or skeletons or dripping blood. Some captains also used red flags, not to look stylish, but to signal no quarter, no mercy. Did pirates bury treasure? Well, this is more fiction than fact. Captain William Kidd did hide some of his loot near Long Island in 1699, hoping to use it to bargain for his life. But most pirates spent their plunder quickly on drink, women, and gambling. There was little point in burying treasure. Did pirates force victims to walk the plank? The plank is a Hollywood invention. Contemporary accounts show that real pirates were more likely to maroon captives on deserted islands or simply throw them overboard. The idea of a plank seems to have originated in the 19th century and was popularized by J.M. Barrie's Peter Pan. Lastly, did pirates say, "Yarr, ya matey"? Well, there's no reason to believe 18th century pirates walked around saying yar, and I'll try not to say that way too many times today. Many pirates came from England's West Country, so their speech reflected that dialect, but the famous growl owes more to actor Robert Newton, whose performance as Long John Silver in the 1950 movie adaptation of Treasure Island inspired the modern pirate accent. In reality, pirates were from all over, so accents were varied. With these smaller mysteries addressed, we can turn to legends that don't have easy answers. And we're going to start with the fate of Anne Bonny. In the autumn of 1720, when Calico Jack Rackham's sloop Revenge was captured near Jamaica, two of the fiercest fighters on board, according to legend, were women, Anne Bonny and Mary Read. Their presence scandalized 18th century society and titillated readers of Captain Charles Johnson's book, A General History of the Robberies and Murders of the Most Notorious Pirates. This book, of which I've owned a copy for a very long time, is the basis for most of our knowledge of pirates of the era. A book that has its own set of strange details and mysteries, which I will cover later in this episode. Anne Bonny's early life is not well documented. Allegedly, she was born around 1698 in County Cork. Then she moved with her father to the province of Carolina, married a small town sailor named James Bonny, and then left him for the charismatic Calico Jack Rackham. Johnson's book describes her as a jolly, brisk woman, not altogether so reserved in modesty. And there's a lot of fascinating aspects of Anne Bonny's story, a lot of it which is purely conjecture and might have been made up just to sell books, includes a romantic relationship with Mary Read, amongst some other things. But the most fascinating aspect of Anne Bonny's tale is the mystery surrounding the end of her life. In November of 1720, she and Rackham's crew were tried at St. Iago de la Vega, which is modern-day Spanish Town in Jamaica, and Bonny and Mary Read were sentenced to hang, but they pleaded pregnancy. Now, we don't know if they were really pregnant or just saying that to prevent death by hanging, but what we do know is Mary Read died in prison of a fever. However, there is no record that Anne Bonny was executed, died in prison, was let go, or otherwise. Here's a quote from Captain Charles Johnson's A General History of Piracy. She was continued in prison to the time of her laying in, and afterwards reprieved from time to time. But what became of her since? We cannot tell. Only this we know, that she was not executed. The Oxford Dictionary of National Biography reports a local legend that Bonny's wealthy father used his influence to ransom her, and that she later remarried a man named Joseph Burley and had several children. There's an alternative legend that says she gave birth to Rackham's child in prison and was quietly released, remarried, and lived until 1782. Neither story is supported by contemporary documentation, and colonial records of baptisms and wills do contain names that might match hers, but there's really nothing conclusive. If Anne Bonny survived a death sentence, at that time she could have hidden under an assumed name, because in a world with few records, such a disappearance is entirely plausible. And maybe one day someone may come across a dusty old pamphlet full of old records or letters, and prove once and for all what happened to Anne Bonny. Our next mystery is a setup that is better than any Hollywood pirate movie ever made. And this is about Labuse's lost treasure. In the harbor of modern-day Reunion Island in the Indian Ocean, Olivier Levasseur, known as Labuse, climbed the steps of the gallows on July 7th, 1730. According to later legend, he threw a cryptogram into the crowd and cried, "My treasure, to he who can understand." Treasure hunters have been searching for this ever since. But does a treasure actually exist at all? Labuse had accumulated riches. In 1721, as an example, his crew captured the Portuguese galleon Nossa Senhora do Cabo, which was laden with gold, diamonds, and religious artifacts. That haul has an estimated value of up to $1 billion in today's money. The cryptogram is the key to the legend, yet the earliest known transcription of the supposed code does not appear until 1934, almost 200 years later, when French archivist Charles de La Rancière published a pigpen cipher in a book about pirates. De La Rancière claimed that the cipher was based on a document held in the archives in the Seychelles, but he provided no original. Some researchers have decoded this cipher, only to find that it contained not directions, but a recipe and pious phrases. A second cryptogram later circulated among treasure hunters, and that was proven to be a hoax. While this story seems to be purely legend, it has endured. Why? Well, first is that Labousse was the exception to the rule that pirates didn't bury treasure, because he actually had a reputation for hiding his loot. Second, you have a code written down, thrown into a crowd by a condemned man, saying it leads to a treasure, and this is a very compelling narrative device. Third is that treasure hunting is a lucrative business in and of itself, and many people and families have devoted years and lots of money to trying to find this treasure. There are some treasure hunters that have followed clues and claim that they know where the treasure is. Their only hurdle is government bureaucracy. Scholars, however, suspect that the cryptogram is a 20th century invention, and that if there was a treasure or loot hidden from Labousse, it has long since been recovered or never existed at all. But perhaps Labousse's greatest treasure is the story itself, a riddle that invites each new generation to search for a buried pirate treasure and live out my lifelong dream of becoming a Goonie. Next is the vanishing of Henry Avery. Avery began as a Royal Navy sailor. In 1694, he led a mutiny aboard the privateer ship Charles II, which was renamed the Fancy after the mutiny, and then set off for the Indian Ocean. And there, Avery captured a Mughal treasure ship carrying pilgrims and enormous wealth. Contemporary accounts describe a fortune of gold, silver, and jewels that has been estimated at hundreds of millions of dollars in today's money. After dividing the spoils, Avery disappeared. The English government had issued a proclamation demanding his arrest, and an international manhunt ensued, but Avery was never found. Legends and rumors grew and multiplied like he had retired in Madagascar, or become a chief of a pirate kingdom, or he returned to England disguised and then died in poverty. But what does the real evidence suggest? We know that English authorities found his crew members and executed several of them, but there is no record of Avery himself. According to historian Colin Woodard, Avery probably sailed to the Bahamas. Another account from an 18th century pamphlet places him living comfortably in Devon until his death. However, the most intriguing lead surfaced only in 2024. Researchers Sean Kingsley and Rex Cowan discovered a coded letter dated 1700 in the National Archives. The letter suggests that Henry Avery, under the alias Bridgeman, may have struck a deal with King William III's government, handing over part of his loot in exchange for a pardon, and in return, he allegedly worked as a spy, passing information about French and Jacobite plots against Britain. A Jacobite, by the way, is a supporter of returning the British throne to the Stuart family after King James II was exiled in the late 17th century. Parts of the code remain undeciphered, and some historians are skeptical that it's real. Additionally, the name Avery is spelled differently in that letter versus some of the records about the pirate Avery, though I will say that spelling was inconsistent back in the 1700s, so it could mean they're the same person or it could mean they're entirely different people altogether, which still means that we have no idea what happened to the pirate Captain Henry Avery. Lastly, what I think is the biggest and perhaps most important mystery in all of the legends and lore surrounding pirates is, who is Captain Charles Johnson? This mystery doesn't involve a treasure, and it doesn't involve sword fights and swinging around on ropes on a ship, and all the things I have wanted to do my whole life. But this really is an important mystery. Throughout this episode, I have mentioned once or twice Captain Charles Johnson's 1724 book, A General History of the Robberies and Murders of the Most Notorious Pirates, and I have used that book as a resource for this episode. The book shaped contemporary and modern perceptions of pirates. It has information that's used when we research people like Blackbeard or Bartholomew Roberts and every other known pirate. Yet there is no record of a sea captain by that name, or records of any captain with that name of any kind from that time in Britain. Johnson is considered a pen name, but for who, we don't know. And if we don't know who wrote the book, how reliable is it? The book compiled biographies of pirates from contemporary news, admiralty records, and mostly oral testimony. Its first volume seems to stick relatively close to trustworthy sources for at least some of the details, but not all of the book. And later volumes, published just a handful of years later, really stretch the truth and even include biographies of at least three pirates that experts think are entirely fictional. So who is Captain Charles Johnson? For much of the 20th century, it was speculated that Daniel Defoe, author of Robinson Crusoe, wrote the book. Literary scholar John Robert Moore spread this theory in 1932. And he cited stylistic similarities and Defoe's interest in pirates and criminals. Many libraries even cataloged the book under Defoe's name, which still leads many to think that he was Captain Charles Johnson. It wasn't until 1988 that this attribution was challenged. Scholars P.N. Furbank and W.R. Owens argued that there was no documented evidence linking Defoe to the book, and that the stylistic parallels were actually commonplace phrases from the time. They also noted inconsistencies between Johnson's accounts of some of the pirates, such as Henry Avery, and Defoe's known works. So another theory has come forward that Nathaniel Mist, a former sailor turned journalist and publisher, was Captain Charles Johnson. What I think is most intriguing about this theory is that Mist operated a printing press near Charles Rivington's bookshop. Rivington is the book's first publisher, and his shop is where the book was most likely first sold. Nathaniel Mist's life also makes him uniquely qualified. He had sailed in the West Indies and was a Jacobite, which explains the book's sympathetic tone towards certain Jacobite pirates. Lastly, the General History of Pirates was registered at Her Majesty's Stationery Office in Mist's name. Now, think of that as an archives or copyright office of the time, but that doesn't mean Mist is Captain Charles Johnson either. Charles Rivington, the publisher, has been considered a potential author. However, his family and records show that he really never dabbled in writing himself, so that's unlikely. And when the second volume came out of the book, it's likely that Rivington, or influence from other intrepid publishers, pushed for a more sensational take on these piracy stories, because in volume two, the author inserts fake pirates, which I already mentioned, and also an entire fake pirate republic, Libertalia, which was considered a utopian colony in Madagascar, and it was a complete fabrication, which is really interesting because there are a lot of YouTube videos that mention this as being a real place. This is all to say, whoever Captain Charles Johnson was in the first volume, there's a good chance that Volume 2 is written not by Captain Charles Johnson, but a new author or a combination of authors. Whoever Captain Charles Johnson was, I think if he were to see how his book has influenced history, he or she would be flabbergasted. It has influenced hundreds of years of history, literature, film, TV, and stage in ways that no one could have imagined back in 1724. And to find out who really wrote the book would help us pinpoint more of the facts in the book or fabrications. Pirate mysteries to me are a perfect mix of history and imagination. Some questions will never be fully answered, and that uncertainty is part of the allure. You've just listened to A Study of Strange. Consider helping us keep the lantern lit, illuminating the unexplained, by subscribing to our Substack. Just head to the support tab at astudyofstrange.com. Or leave a quick review and tap that subscribe button. Until next time, stay curious and stay strange.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.